So we're not sure right now what the governor thinks about the impeachment inquiry. Here's why. When asked by Alan Shartok of WAMC, he said, quote, "You're darn right there should be an inquiry." But at an event yesterday with former New Jersey Governor Chris Christie, he seemed much less certain. According to Politico, he predicted that Congress is headed down, quote, "a very long and unproductive road." So what does all this mean? Let's ask Dan Clark, who is a reporter with the New York Law Journal, and Keisha Klukey, who is a correspondent with Bloomberg Law. Welcome. How are you?
Good.
Hi.
Happy Friday. So what is going on with the governor's views of impeachment? Do you know why he would say two different things, Dan?
That's a great question. I have no idea, and I would love to know, and I would love for him to clarify. Is he for the impeachment inquiry or is he not for the impeachment inquiry?
What do you think?
And I think that this is going to be, I think his two responses are kind of showing what everyone is doing right now as far as Democrats in the state. I mean, you're seeing like Anthony Brindisi, congressman, had said, "I don't support this," or "I'm waiting for details." I think they're trying to figure out how to best play in Republican markets if they're seen as the, you know, more leftist or kind of where they're at for the upcoming elections.
I think Keisha's exactly right. I think next year what you're going to see is this impeachment inquiry drag on forever. And I think Republicans running in districts, especially upstate, are going to use it against their Democratic candidates. They're going to try to align them with AOC down in the city, and they're going to try to align them as the leftist people. And that's interesting because that's what the governor said last night at Chris Christie's event. He said that Nancy Pelosi was basically forced to do this by the, quote, leftist Democrats, which, you know, kind of brings to the table, what would he label himself as if not a leftist? Because he frequently calls himself one of the most progressive governors in the country.
He has also positioned himself as more of a moderate and certainly a pragmatist, don't you think?
Depending on where he is in the state at the time.
Okay, so yeah. are we saying that the governor may have tailored his message to his audience?
Just a little
what
bit.
A shock. Yes.
Okay. Well, I think that probably a lot of politicians do that. So this will be clarified, I'm sure, over the next 24 hours or so. So another issue that was buttoned down this week were the changes to how you can enroll in a party or how soon you need to enroll in a party once you decide if you want to enroll in a party. Keisha, you wrote about this. Tell us what's up.
Yeah, so basically you used to have to wait almost, voters would have to wait almost up to a year if they changed their party or enrolled in a party before voting in the November elections. And basically the governor just signed legislation this week that moved the enrollment to February 14th. So your Valentine's Day surprise here, you get to vote in the April, both the April presidential primary and then also the June state primaries. And if you are after that February 14th date, then you get to vote after the June primary. So you would still be able to vote that next fall.
Gotcha. What a fun Valentine's Day
it
date
is.
Idea.
Let's go and register or change our registration. Exactly. Another thing is that there was sort of some concern that the governor was not signing this legislation. What happened there?
Yeah, I mean, the governor's office will tell you they have about 900 bills that they have to go through between June, especially this year because they passed so many, between June and, you know, the end of the year. What happened was a lot of people on the internet were speaking up and saying, hey, why hasn't the governor signed this yet? Because if he doesn't sign it by this date in October, then it might not be extended. And there was this discussion
over that.
So they're
freaking out. And I think Bernie Sanders entered the fray.
Bernie Sanders put his voice in because, as you remember, this was a problem in 2016 because a lot of voters didn't realize they had to register as a Democrat a year before the primary in order to vote in it. So a lot of people were left out of that primary where they would want to vote for Bernie.
So the governor has signed it. And now if you have decided, you know, I am currently a Democrat and I want to become a Republican or vice versa, you can do that between now and Valentine's Day.
There you go.
Thank you.
So, Dan, meanwhile, the president is fighting on at least one front in the legal war that New York is waging against him. I mean, there's like, how many lawsuits are there right now that New York has filed against the president or his administration?
Well, when Eric Schneiderman was the attorney general at the end of the first year of the president, when he was in the presidency, the AG's office had filed 100 suits by then. So
and
it's
we have just more
bit.
Now.
Yeah, it's been a little bit since then. So hundreds, so many.
So right now, President Trump is challenging the state's demands for his tax return. What's the latest?
Yeah, your listeners might remember the Trust Act. It's the legislation passed in June, I believe. It allows three committee chairpersons in Congress to request his tax returns from the State Department of Taxation and Finance. Right. So what's happening is this suit was filed in Washington, D.C. by the president. Tish James and her attorneys want it to be either dismissed against them because they say, we live in New York, so you can't really sue us in Washington and, you know, just do it with the House of Representatives if you're going to do it. But what they're saying now is if you drop us from the suit, you really can't challenge the constitutionality of the Trust Act because then you're suing the House of Representatives over the constitutionality of a state law.
Oh,
and they're saying you can't do that.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah. So we're waiting for that motion to be decided. But there was just a letter yesterday from Tish James's office with just like a little paragraph at the bottom. Very interesting where they just said, oh, and by the way, Judge, Donald Trump is a resident of New York. We looked at the voter rolls. He's an active voter here. So if you're going to decide on where the suit should be, it's not in Washington, D.C., because he doesn't live there.
When is that going to be decided?
Anyone's guess, but the judge said last week during a hearing that he was not going to decide it swiftly. So I would say sometime over the next month, but probably not in the coming days.
All right. Another lawsuit is... Well, what did you say? Keisha had a great headline for this one about vaping.
The vapors strike back.
Vapors strike back. So the vapors are suing. They're suing the state.
This is such an interesting lawsuit, and it's kind of the same conflict that you see when anybody sues the state over a regulation like this. The balance is who has more power in the regulation and lawmaking authority? Can a member of the executive branch, the governor, essentially codify these regulations over vaping, or does that need to happen through the legislature?
Right.
We've seen this in court cases before. A fake case very reminiscent to this about 30 years ago called Borealli versus Axelrod. I'm getting a little into the weeds, but follow me through. It's very important.
Yeah.
The same public health council that did the vaping ban did a ban in the 1990s in the late 1980s, I should say, about smoking tobacco in public places, and that was struck down in the courts. So if we see the same pattern exist today and the same kind of thinking, you may see the vaping ban also struck down under that same logic.
And what was the logic?
The logic is basically that the Public Health Council did not have the authority to issue this regulation. It had to be done by the legislature.
And the vaping businesses are saying that, you know, this would be a huge issue for them. They'd go out of business, especially I know a number of them on Long Island are very concerned.
Exactly. What you'll see in the coming days is a motion for a preliminary injunction that's based on irreparable harm. And if they can show that they're shutting down these businesses and laying these people off, that is certainly irreparable harm that can be argued to enforce an injunction.
This is also related to, in a way, the habit now of the legislature outsourcing its power to unelected commissions. It's something that we talk about, have spoken about with the Pay Raise Commission, and now with the Public Campaign Finance Reform Commission. And this is not the legislature, but it's the governor who is sort of taking a little power away from the legislature, too. Pretty soon we might not need a legislature if we keep doing this. Chief Judge Janet DeFiore is also in the news. She discussed a need to fund civil legal services this week.
Yeah, it's a big need in the state. Some people call it a constitutional right. It's not enshrined in the Constitution, but what the state has done over the past couple of years is boost the funding for civil legal services to $100 million in the state budget. When we're talking about civil legal services, these are attorneys for low-income individuals in New York that need access to a civil matter. So we're talking about stuff like family law, renters who want to go to court over
evictions,
their landlords. Exactly. And these people can't afford to hire an attorney.
It's basically everything except a crime. Because if you commit a crime, you get an attorney appointed to you.
Right. And sometimes that's not even very great because they have such big caseloads. And
yeah.
That's
the
a
defense
whole
attorneys.
Separate issue that we could talk about another time.
Absolutely.
But Janet
DeFiore.
No, the New York City Bar Association president, not the New York State. he called on, and several individuals did at a hearing, that they want more funding for this. $100 million we just got in 2016. So they're saying boost it even more, because statewide, especially outside of New York City, there is a huge need for these attorneys.
Doesn't Janet DeFiore also, isn't she also interested in reforming or modernizing the courts? The way actually Judith Kay was also very involved in that as well. She's the late former Chief Justice Judith Kay.
And she actually just put out a proposal this week that would downsize from 11 trial courts. We have the most trial courts in the nation, and I think they were saying the world as far as a complex system.
Yeah.
And when you're talking about these attorneys that are being appointed, so let's say you have a victim of domestic abuse and they have children, they may have to go to 3 separate courts to file for the charges against abuse, and in that case, they may have an attorney appointed to them, but then they can't file for divorce. They wouldn't, if they can't afford an attorney, and also the custody court to get the custody of the children. So it's kind of, as actually Hank Greenberg said, it's just a mess, and they've been trying to reform it for decades now. And she,
if only there was some way we could have amended the Constitution.
Yes.
Oh, my goodness.
Well, and so she is proposing that we do just that, have this smaller number, only 3, basically, the Supreme Court, municipal, and then keeping the local level courts. She actually tackled that in an interesting way, because one of the issues that kept it bogged down in the past was how judges are appointed, and it kind of made all of the discussion focus around that. So she's saying these judges, whether they're moving into the Supreme Court or municipal court, they're going to be appointed the same exact way.
That's interesting. And we're going to be speaking with somebody from next week we're speaking with somebody from the chief administrative judge about how all of this would work. I want to thank you both. Hank Greenberg isn't up next, so we're sort of teasing that, but Dan Clark, reporter with the New York Law Journal, Keisha Kluge, correspondent with Bloomberg Law. It's been great. Thank you.
Thanks. Thank you.
Support for the Capitol Press Room is provided by New York State United Teachers, a union of professionals in education, human services, and healthcare.
So we were going to talk with Hank Greenberg. He is the president of the New York State Bar Association, about a new book that the Bar Association has just published called Is America Fulfilling Its Promise? Safeguarding Legal Protections for Immigrants. But Hank isn't here, so we are very lucky to have Dan Clark, who is a reporter for the New York Law Journal, and
guess
Keisha Kluge, correspondent with Bloomberg Law. There's a lot more to talk about under the umbrella of, you know, legal stuff in New York, and modernizing the court is really, it's something that needs to happen. And Chief Judge, you guys wouldn't remember this, but she put out Chief Judge Judith Kay, back in the 90s, put out this whole modernizing New York's courts, a whole, you know, book about it, basically.
Exactly.
And all right, yeah, okay. And nothing has been done. Why is it so hard to fix the court system?
There's no appetite among lawmakers in the legislature.
Interesting.
What has to happen to do this reform that Judge DeFiore is proposing? And you're right, Chief Judge Judith Kay was the first chief judge to actually put this forward as a very comprehensive proposal. What has to happen is a constitutional amendment. So the legislature would have to vote on it. Then the next legislature that's voted in has to vote on it, which could be either the year after or 2 years later. And then after that, it has to go to voters. So lawmakers in the legislature just don't have the appetite for it. They don't understand really why it's necessary. They don't see why there's a need for it. And to be honest with you, the people of the state of New York probably don't understand that there could be a better way.
No, the law... all the judiciary and the law, the court system, it's all very obtuse. I mean, it's
right.
Not easily understood. Just like the part, this part, that part, I don't understand it, and I'm here all the time.
You hire an attorney, and then the attorney tells you what to do. That's what happens in New York State unless you represent yourself, which unfortunately happens all too often.
Yeah. And I actually spoke to Chief Administrative Judge Marks, the second in command under DeFiore, and he was saying that, you know, once we make it, if we make it through the legislature, which could happen,
which is
potentially this year, it has to have a vote.
Yeah.
It has to have a vote in the legislature twice by a separately elected legislature. So actually, it could happen this year, 2021, and then be on the ballot in 2021. And then it has a 5-year phase-in, this plan does, because it's going to take a lot of moving parts. And he was saying that one of the big things they'll focus on is just public awareness and making people realize why this is needed and how it would affect them. And it would actually save a lot of money for those people going through the process. We had said before, you know, maybe one issue would have to go in 3 different courts. You're talking about 3 different attorneys, potentially. You're talking about taking off work for 3 different separate court proceedings.
And let's say you're talking about a family court judge situation or family court situation.
Exactly.
That's somebody's going through a divorce. You know, you have to go to one. If there's kids, you have to go to another. And if, you know, there are other criminal issues, you have to go to another. It's ridiculous and time consuming. And if you don't have a lot of money, can you imagine having to take off work?
I could not imagine having to take off work. It's impossible for some people to get justice in the state.
Yeah.
And it's not necessarily at the fault of them or at the fault of anybody immediately around them. It's at the fault of the system, because a lot of the times we made it so complicated.
So in terms of the people who might be lobbying against this change, who would that be?
So that would be kind of the trade associations for judges around the state. Take, for example, and I don't know their position on it, so don't take this as fact, the family court judges do have an association. Say you're a family court judge, and this plan would essentially have you become a Supreme Court justice, and that's just not to confuse the listeners, that's the lowest level of court in the state of New York.
Of course it is, because it's the most confusing.
Yeah, so if you're right now presiding over a courtroom where you're only dealing with family law and family matters, and now the court system is coming in and saying, we're going to make you a Supreme Court justice, and you're going to have to deal with a lot more than that now, you might be a little wary to sign on to that proposal.
However, it does come with a pay raise, so there might be some movement there. As you're becoming a Supreme Court judge, you're now going to be paid as a Supreme Court judge. But there will be some consolidation, so potentially not necessarily in the judgeships, but in the administrative process, there could be some
court clerks, things like that.
That'll be moving around. And then just the lawmakers, when they're looking at their decision, you know, these are positions of power in these communities, and people want them. They want to have this. They, you know, have worked their whole life to be this, and now we're switching up the system. And there might be some hesitation in the legislature to, you know, cause a ruckus in their communities.
It's also something that a lot of lawmakers have never thought about before. Maybe they've heard a whispering of it, but they've never actually talked about
considered. It's never been considered you know, in a really legitimate way.
Exactly.
Let's put it that way.
And if enacted, this would be the most comprehensive change in state government in decades. So they may be hesitant to sign on to it.
So this just in, Hank Greenberg, he is here. So I want to thank you both. Dan Clark of the New York Law Journal. Keisha Klucke is with a correspondent with Bloomberg Law. You guys really, again, pulling my tushy out of the sling. So thank you. And have a good day. So again, we're going to have Hank Greenberg step in now. We're going to be talking about a book called Is America Fulfilling Its Promise? Now, the past several years have seen an almost constant series of changes to immigration law, followed by protests, lawsuits, and ultimately either injunctions or reforms. So the State Bar Association has created a guidebook for lawyers and those organizations that work with New York's immigrant communities titled, Is America Fulfilling Its Promise? Safeguarding Legal Protections for Immigrants. For more on this project, I'm joined in the studio by New York State Bar Association President Hank Greenberg, and it's good to see you.
Good to see you, Susan.
So we only have a few minutes, but why did you put this book together?
Well, we are in the midst of a contentious national debate over immigration with people with strong feelings on both sides of many issues. There's a lot of misinformation and a lot of confusion about what the applicable laws are and rules, particularly for members, communities, local governments, states, cities that are not entirely enthralled with what the federal government is doing. So the New York State Bar Association considers it part of its core mission to educate and inform the public. And it seemed like a particularly good time to provide a book with scholars and thoughtful commentators sharing their views on these important issues.
The contributors are like a who's who of New York immigration law, Sarah Rogerson, Camille Mackler, Stephen Yale Lair. You write in the introduction, this book shows how a nation built on immigrants can and should treat those who come to our shores in search of a better life, in search of better lives. So the perspective here is about ensuring rights, not stripping them away.
Exactly right. The title of the book, Is America Fulfilling Its Promise, is meant to be provocative. I think the answer, is America fulfilling its promise question, the answer is no, America is not, but New York State is. New York State's government, the governor, the chief judge, the legislature has stepped up to the plate, and given New York State's unique connection to immigration, the Statue of Liberty sits in New York Harbor. New York has long been a refuge for immigrant populations from around the world. So, yes, the point of the book is to make clear what the rights are of immigrants generally, as well as undocumented New Yorkers.
Is this an easy read for a non-lawyer?
It's designed to be. It is at once a citizen's guide, so it can be read by laypersons, non-lawyers, but it's also written for policymakers in government, state and federal, as well as lawyers.
So the state bar does a lot of different things, puts on a lot of different programs. This is one of the things you do. What else is the state bar doing for immigrants?
Well, we have taken a variety of positions. Our House of Delegates, which is our policy-making body, as well as our executive committee, has, over the course of the last couple of years, issued some important resolutions and proclamations. For example, it's the position of the State Bar Association that immigrants should have a statutory right to counsel.
And it's something that the governor, I think, has talked about, too. We've been speaking with Hank Greenberg. The book is America Fulfilling Its Promise? Editors Scott Fine, Rosemary Bailey, I want to thank you very much.
Thank you, Susan.
Support for WCNY's Capitol Press Room is provided by the 16th Annual Syracuse International Film Festival, October 3rd and 11th through 13th. Films from around the world with screenings at the Red House Arts Center, Palace Theater, and SU's Schemann Auditorium. Tickets and hotel accommodations at syrfilm.com.